and welcome to the show. This is episode number 3 of the brand new, I guess, well, I don't know if it's brand new anymore, podcast. This is exciting for a couple of reasons. One is I have a fellow contributor to Down the Line magazine with us, Doug Peterson, and also I'm in my home studio, so we'll see actually how this works out. Recording this not on a computer. I've gone old school and I bought a Zoom H4N Pro, so I am speaking into that now in my studio into a microphone, and I've kind of rigged it up to where Doug is actually coming in on the phone, so hopefully this will sound okay, and I'm hoping we'll actually get a better mix because I can mix two channels now instead of just one coming in through into a mono file. So anyway, Doug, it sounds pretty good on your end?
I can hear just fine. Testing.
Excellent. All right. Well, that sounds sounds great. And Doug, we've never spoken before, besides the few minutes that we talked before the interview here. But we've emailed quite a bit.
Yeah.
And you've come on and contributed some really cool stuff, some interviews, some reviews to Down the Line. I'm sure people have read them. You seem to like maybe some harder edged music. So tell us what attracted you to Down the Line, and what kind of stuff musically excites you that's going on today.
Well, when I first was exposed to Down the Line, I think I saw it originally maybe on Facebook or something like that. So I checked it out, and this was pretty early on. And, you know, I had some, I can't remember what my affiliation was with Steve Ruff and, Matt, but I remember just being intrigued by all the bands that I was familiar with. Some of the bands were doing new stuff, maybe coming back after 15, 20 years. There was, I thought the reviews were really cool. And also the writing, it was, I thought it was pretty honest and it wasn't censored. So there was no, the gatekeepers weren't there. And so I was, you know, I was just really stoked by that. And then after, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I figured, well, why don't I, this intrigues me so much, why don't I get plugged in and involved? So I sent Matt a message, and he said, okay, sure, you know, why don't you review something? And then went from there.
Excellent. What was the first thing you reviewed?
I can't remember. I think it might have been something hard. It might have been something on Rottweiler Records. I don't really remember what it was, but you know, and but I'm enjoying a lot more of the stuff I'm digging now. So, yeah, I do tend to, you know, my background is in the heavier stuff, but I'm all over the place when it comes to music. So,
excellent. I know. One interesting thing about Down the Line and about the music that we cover is people's faith position, if you want to call it that, right now. And one thing that intrigued me was when the magazine started interviewing these people who seemed, some of them, like just disappeared. You know, even when Facebook started or whatever, like you couldn't find a trace of any of these, some of these people that I really, you know, liked. And then, you know, Steve or Matt or somebody hunted them down. And then all of a sudden, there's a whole new story and a story of why they've kind of disappeared and maybe changed their position. And I was kind of, I wasn't really laughing at this, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, Dave Bazan, after he, came out, with a different position, still is playing, you know, Audio Feed Festival. It's a weird place we live to where, post-Christians or however people want to define themselves are actually still engaging in the conversation. Ojo Taylor too. I mean, I guess a few years back, you know, they played an undercover show somewhere. Maybe it was many years back, but it happened after he changed his faith position as well. So I find that fascinating that the dialogue can still occur if people are willing to have the dialogue between Christians, post-evangelicals or whatever. And people can still kind of come around the music and in a sane way, which is very refreshing in today's age, actually continue a dialogue. So I know some of the people you've interviewed, Ojo, in the last episode. So what's your thoughts on that whole phenomenon?
Yeah, that's one thing that I was really excited about as well. I remember going through past issues, you know, where people like Sean Doty and Doug Pinnick and other people who we all know spent time in the faith scene for a while. And, you know, and nowadays when you talk to them, they're at a very different place. And it's not like they haven't thought through it. You know, in fact, it's just the opposite. It's because they've processed it and processed it a lot that they're in a different place. And, you know, so, you know, when an opportunity comes up, you know, I really love, you know, reading about people's journeys and where they find themselves. And, you know, that's just one of the things that really excites me is seeing where a person was and how they got to be where they're at now.
So how do we keep this dialogue continuing? Because obviously, I mean, I can tell you my personal experience. I didn't go to church for about 8 years, you know, because there was just no dialogue happening. When I would question things, particularly eschatology, you know, end time stuff, or the election versus free will, you know, those sorts of things. If you say something that's just wrong, there's really not a lot of patience. They just ask you to leave. So it's one amazing event that I went to was it was called Loosen the Bible Belt with Jay Baker. I went to it twice, and it was great because there was all these people that probably haven't been to church, you know, like me in 10 years or whatever. But then they're coming out to this, and there was some healing, you know, that was taking place there. But it seems like the actual dialogue might be happening on the fringe. It's not happening in the mainstream. So, what do you think we're doing right to continue that dialogue or to keep it alive?
Well, what are we doing right? Okay. I think, if anything, you know, because, we're living in an age where, you know, on Facebook, people are pretty much free to say what they want. And so you're getting a whole lot more people's input on life and life issues.
All right. I think we got reconnected there.
Yeah. I'm not sure what happened. We just went out. But anyways, okay, continue on. What was I saying? Well, you know, the dialogue is continuing with people. One of the things I think we're doing right is, you know, we're listening to each other a lot more. And I think, you know, it's hard to judge somebody if you yourself have gone through some life changes and you've had your own thought processes challenged and tweaked a bit. So, if anything, there's a more openness to, look at something. And, you know, instead of doing the micro approach of examining every little doctrine, rather saying, okay, what is the metaphor for which I'm seeing this as now? And discussing it from that perspective.
Interesting. What do you think then that the church is doing? Why do you think they have their defenses up so much about certain boundaries that keep people out? Because if you look at the Pew Research stuff, I mean, people have left the church by the millions. And I think it's somewhere near 90% of college students who leave church the generation X or Y, what the hipster, the whatever generation that's in college right now, they'll never come back. So I know they're wondering and concerned about it, but it doesn't seem like they're necessarily doing anything to fix the problem. Mm.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like when you first start going to a church and you feel like you're dealing with people, there's some, you know, cool elements that you're getting involved in at the church. You know, you're wide open to learn, you know, and you're excited. And then maybe after some time passes, you know, your thoughts change about things. You know, do I really believe in a hell and fire brimstone type thing, or do I really believe in, you know, a literal penal substitution? And you start thinking through things, and as you talk to people, you realize, yeah, I don't really believe that anymore, or it's not like, you know, I know, like, that's what I've just said is probably going to rub against some people who are, you know, you got to go back to the Bible, you know, chapter verse, you know, but, I've really come to believe that, you know, the most powerful thing is when we can see something that has meaning to us and absorb it, as opposed to conversing with people and having to argue out your point, you know.
Well, I think it seems like you've been in some of those church arguments as well as I have. I think part of it is the way the dialogue happens. So I was listening to, there's a debate show called Unbelievable, fantastic show. It's on a regular radio station, terrestrial radio station in the UK. And so there was a former young earth creationist debating a young earth creationist, right? And I tried to avoid those debates a lot, but I haven't listened to the show in a while on that subject. And so let me just dive in and see what new tactics people are using. And the young earth creationist said to the other guy, he said, well, I don't want to stand before God and say, you're a liar. And so the other guy said, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of time to respond, but the response was, well, I'm not saying God's a liar. I just don't believe in the same interpretation you do. But that seems to be the essence of the dialogue, right? And it's not coming from us. It's coming from the people who maybe claim they want us there in the church. But then when you say something like that, There's a definite line being drawn, and that's the nature of the debate. I mean, you mentioned, well, let's go back to the Bible verses, but if someone really, especially a teenager, who's having questions and issues, or a college student, trying to debate or argue with someone who's well-seasoned, there's some of those debate techniques or the way you phrase things that really is an unfair way to argue. Have you faced any of those personally?
Yeah, I can recall, there's that whole C.S. Lewis thing of Jesus being either Lord, liar, or lunatic. And that kind of sets up a debate right there of, if you don't believe this, it's right there, plain, clear, black and white in Scripture, you know, that Jesus said this about himself. But I think if you frame it that way, you're very much wanting to debate somebody. You know, we're going to strong arm you into this corner, and you've got to say this, versus, you know, maybe there's other ways of looking at this, why not, read about this and make up your mind about, what it is that you believe. And I think that sometimes, we make it so black and white that people just feel like, man, I'm out of here. I'm not for this discussion at all, you know. And I think sometimes churches can serve us, but I also think that they can hold us back from, really thinking for ourselves on what does this verse mean to me? What is this, when I read this gospel or I read this chapter, what is that saying to me, as opposed to, somebody saying what it should say to you,
So we have a bad conversation, happening here. And I was in that same boat. I asked a lot of questions, and I asked a lot of questions to some very uninformed Sunday school teachers who told me a lot of really bad stuff. That's a problem. And eventually, I went away like most people do. There's questions being asked that it seems like the church isn't willing to answer, which is problematic because the Bible says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that you have. But one thing, the buzzwords I think that are sometimes used are things like clearly. Well, brother, the Bible clearly says this. Well, if it clearly says it, then we wouldn't be having a discussion about it, right? So there's a lot of I find manipulative techniques that people use in order to put the other person in put them in hell already, just like that what I just mentioned before, you know, well, I don't want to stand before the throne and call God a liar. It seems like at that point, the conversation's over. Like you really, there's no forward momentum of that. So
yeah, I can't win in your eyes. So I'm all, you know, we'll just declare you the winner and let's move on.
Exactly. And then people leave the church and then, you know, they that's it. You know, they're trying to figure out things on their own. I guess the good thing about the internet is it is like the, you know, the advent of Gutenberg's press. You can, if you do have a question about something, you can find some really bad information, but you can also find some really good information. And there's tons of seminaries that offer free classes online. So there's a lot of stuff that, can, keep you going and maybe find out, some different views of things. So I know for me, that's what helped me a lot to keep the faith, even though my faith is now totally different than it was, 20, 25 years ago. What kept you, engaged in the faith?
Well, okay. I spent, a number of years, missionary work and, you know, that's basically what brought me to Vancouver back in the 80s. And prior to that, I spent a summer at Jesus People USA in Chicago. And, you know, so I had this sort of my eyes were very much caught in the whole thing of, you know, I can make a difference in the world. And I did that for a number of years. But then, maybe it's something about my personality, but I just, kept coming, rubbing against people that, rubbed me the wrong way. And, these were my coworkers. And, I just like, you know, what is this? You know, like, you know, they want to argue with me about these things, you know, and it seems like such trivial stuff. I just can't get into this. And then I would, I started doing these, what we call a temple tour, where we take people to various, like we take them to a mosque, we take them to a Sikh temple, Hare Krishna temple, and to expose young people to, you know, other religions. And so I did that for a while. And, I think it was through dialoguing with people of other faith traditions that I realized these people are just as earnest and sincere about their beliefs as I am. And they are just as much 100% committed to prayer and meditation and, you know, studying the scripture as I am. I have a really hard time saying, well, they're just the wrong religion, you know, and when they stand in front of God, they're going to have to answer for that. You know, because I thought to myself, you know, if I was born in India and, you know, and my parents were Hindu and that's what I was exposed to, how open would I be to somebody that came to my village and talked to me about a faith tradition that was completely foreign to me, you know, and then say, if you don't convert, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. And that really got me thinking, you know. So I was really cautious about how I want to present religions, because we do a follow-up talk afterwards with the kids. And, you know, and they... I said, you know, we can't be quick to, you know, talk about differences because, you know, they probably see us as very different too, you know. So, I mean, that kind of opened my eyes. And then secondly, probably around 99, 2000, I was recently married. I was married then. And I wanted to sort of try to figure out, you know, where am I at with my belief system now? So I enrolled in a very liberal seminary, Vancouver School of Theology, and I went there for 3 years trying to figure out, you know, what. And I had the luxury of doing that because, you know, I was still a visitor in Canada, and I was still receiving support money at that time. So I was very fortunate to have, you know, to look at things from a different perspective altogether. And, you know, and I really remember sitting in classrooms and they were like just, you know, the higher criticism and all that, just, you know, it seems like there's nothing in the Bible that I was taught that is ever sacred enough to hold on to, you know, the Noah's Ark, you know, Jonah and the whale, all these are stories. And I'm just like, no, they're not stories. They happened, you know? And I really wanted to argue for that, but I realized I had no ground to stand on, you know? But, you know, it was a very fascinating 3 years for me, and very grueling. And I remember going to, you know, pastors and, you know, telling them my struggle with, you know, this is what they're doing to me. They're tearing my faith apart, you know? And I think at that time, no one really knew what to say to me, because they're like, you know, well, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it'll heal you, you know, so.
Well, yeah, but the percentages show that it's most people leave at that point, right?
Yeah. And I saw that happen too. You know, I saw some people just check out at that point, you know. And it was 3 years, including summers, of just continuous. Every time I went to use the bathroom, I had a book in my hand. Like, that's just how rigorous it was. You know, they tried to cram 7 years into 3 years. And you get this education, and you don't have any time to process it. It's just you're spitting out new words and facts and understandings, and you're trying to make sense of it all. And then for the 5 years after that, that's exactly what I tried to do. And I realized, you know, I can't simply fall into place with what I knew before. You know, everything has changed. And I even went through a little bit of an agnostic phase for a while, where, you know, I was being exposed to, you know, different ideas and stuff like that, and the church really seemed like more like a chore for me to go to. And so I was sort of like, okay, if there's a God out there, God's going to catch me, because right now I'm just, you know, I'm too frustrated and upset to really read another book. So, and that's, you know, and I think it was through that after going through that, my faith was restored, and I could once again, you know, have sort of a relationship with it again. So, but that's sort of like, I think, Paul Ricoeur, an author, calls it the second naivety. When, you know, you originally had a God experience, and that thing carried you through for a lot of years. But that's not going to be the rest of your life. And then, you might be disappointed with God for a while, or with the experiences you've had in church, however you want to put it. And then something might happen where you're like, okay, I can see this from a different perspective now, and the light's still in my life. I can go on, you know.
I'm glad.
And for some people,
go ahead.
I guess what I was going to say, for some people, though, like Joe Taylor, you know, it might be that, you know, no, this thing is dead. You know, I feel a lot more alive not believing in this than believing in it. And so, you know, and for, you know, personal revelations and experiences, they choose that, you know, like, I just don't know that I can believe in that anymore. And so that becomes their new path. And so that there's that too, you know. So I don't think, you know, my path is necessarily everybody's path. But and some people might even understand this path that I, you know, I've chosen. But you know, I think we have to appreciate the fact that, you know, people have put a lot of work into it, and not everybody is just simply checking out because they're, you know, giving up on it.
Right. No, absolutely. Since you brought up Paul Ricoeur, maybe I'll play devil's advocate a little bit, particularly with
mm-hmm,
that.
Okay. Because
actually, I just went to a discussion group where we discussed that post. Second naivety and post critical thinking, and we read a paper by, I won't mention his name, but he mentions the idea that he mentions two examples of where he says the Bible was wrong. To where we have to come back and look at it from a different perspective. One of them is the idea of all the atrocities that happened in the Old Testament, and the second one was that Jesus was wrong concerning his imminent return. And that's where I kind of like said, no, hold on a second, because there's people, Brian Zahn, Greg Boyd, Peter Enns, there's people who can give you biblical alternatives than at least how mm-hmm. I was taught about what was actually going on in the Old Testament. Michael Heiser, I mean, there's tons of orthodox, if you want to put these people in the orthodox mm-hmm. camp, I do, Christians who can say, well, no, let's look at this a different way. And then the imminent return of Christ, on the second episode, the last episode of this show, I interviewed Brian Godawa, who's a orthodox preterist, who says Jesus was actually talking about the temple destruction. So I think from some perspective, mm-hmm. I can see where it seems like maybe people... I think sometimes maybe this is going a little bit too far. I don't know if you have to reject orthodox beliefs. Maybe you can look at it a little bit differently. But I think maybe that's where the church is responding to, is they see somebody who maybe is starting to read this stuff or look at this stuff differently. And all of a sudden they're like, oh no, you don't have to go that far. And then it becomes a fight of the extremes. Because we're naming names and doing things instead of actually continuing that dialogue. Do you see any of that going on?
Yeah, I don't find very helpful when people feel that they're so sophisticated in their thinking that they can just put a roadblock up at, you know, if you believe this, you're an idiot, or you're kind of believing in ancient myths, you know. I don't think that's very helpful at all.
But then don't we do that same thing, though? I mean, could you, let's take, I don't know, let's just take creation because that's a hot topic, right? It seems like there might be name calling on both sides, right? So if somebody's gone through the naive phase and then the unbelief phase and now they're in the post-critical phase, I've seen it on both ends, right? I mean, you have Jerry Falwell arguing against, Richard Dawkins. That seems to be the dialogue there, right? And nobody mm-hmm. in the middle is saying, well, no, there needs to be a dialogue somewhere in the middle. You have people posting up on both ends, calling each other fools.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you believe that is pure science, science can't prove that anything actually ever did happen because we weren't there back then. We don't know how it happened. We just have a understanding of that, you know, likely this is how it happened. But, you know, I mean, from a Christian who, and I grew up with, believing that, you know, it was a literal 6 days and God rested on the seventh. I mean, I held on to that. And I think I don't have any problem with that as a way of understanding, but also that, you know, it's kind of limited in that, you know, the world's pretty young if you believe that, and that doesn't explain science and scientific findings and, you know, fossils and all that. I think, you know, faith and science is a, they're great partners to dialogue with, but I think, you know, whenever you hold one up as this is how you have to look at it, then I think you kind of set yourself up that, you know, you have to be absolutely correct about this. It's not very helpful, I don't find.
It's not, and I see it on both ends. If you start to corrode someone's faith who is, a fundamentalist, that, you know, once one thing falls down, everything else kind of just starts, you know, falling as well. But there's some presuppositions I think that both sides have. I mean, you mentioned the age of the earth. I would say that your presupposition is, you're looking at things from a scientific perspective where the church's presupposition is the Bible is the authority. So they would dismiss you by saying, well, your problem is that you're not using the Bible as your authority. You're using science and things that are observable, which are not the Word of God.
Yeah, but at the same time, even though you're looking at, people may have thought through things a lot more mystical or more spiritual back then. And if you go to, you know, other parts of the world, you know, you'll see that, you know, people are still thinking in a lot more mystical way than we do here in the Western world. We're very caught up in, you know, we want to know, we want to go to scientific journals and discovery magazines and you know, find out things and then be certain about it, you know. That's not the approach that other people take in other parts of the world. And, in Middle Eastern, text might be that, you know, the world was, they have to I think they created things with story, you know, and I think rather than just dismantling that, we should see the fascination behind the story. Like, this is a beautiful story, and what can we learn from this, you know, and what does that say about the character of God and these kind of things, as opposed to just, you know, yeah, let's just dismantle that.
Yeah, sometimes when people ask me what I like to do in my spare time, I say I like to impose modern literary conventions on ancient texts, just because that's what I think the church does a lot, you know, right? You know, these things that were written in completely different methods. I listened to another discussion. It wasn't really a debate. It was a discussion on how Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are more written like a first century, i.e. Plutarch, biography than they are history. And we make a lot of mistakes when we're imposing our idea of how history should be written onto people 2,000 years ago. You know, they had a whole different idea of how history should be written. So I guess the question is, you know, I'm still angry. I'll admit to that about what I was taught and brainwashed with as a kid. But the fact is right now is not everybody's looking back at it, laughing at it. I mean, you mentioned Jesus People USA. There's a documentary out on YouTube that mentions some even much more horrific things than I've ever encountered or experienced that went on. And growing up in church, just being lied to, I feel, was it's hard to overcome those things, because if you grow up in an evangelical church, you're out there spreading the lies as well, right? So I'm out there as a young person telling people, you know, the same BS that I was taught. So the problem now is, as I mentioned before, you know, we got millions of people that don't go to church. We have this huge divide, yet that's not what Christ called us to. So how do we heal this divide? I know our little magazine and podcast is not going to be the fixer upper, right? We're not going to have the Southern Baptist Convention going, yeah, we listen to that podcast and we're going to, you know, change some things. How does that happen? I mean, thank God the Holy Spirit's there, because that's where the power is. But do you see anything positive happening in this, or do you see any change, or do you see the divide continuing to grow?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a really good inquiry. I quite don't know. Most of the people that I associate with on an everyday basis, most would be agnostic or atheist. A lot of times, you know, religion and spirituality doesn't even come up in our conversations. Sometimes it does, you know. I guess I want to go back to something you said. I don't necessarily believe that, you know, growing up in the church, even if it's like a very, you know, doctrinal type church, is necessarily being brainwashed. I think people are very sincere in their beliefs, and they're simply passing on what they've heard and what they've studied under their schooling. So I give them a lot more, lack of a better word, grace for, you know, trying to pass that on in a way. But how do you divide that gap? That's a really good question. And I think, you know, I can think of a lot of ways that it doesn't happen. you know, a lot of conversations that take place where, you know, the gap is just growing further and further. I don't know. What do you think? I'm kind of stuck right there.
Yeah, I don't know, because in America, you know, we have the political thing going on too, and I feel like they're kind of combined. I know, you know.
Oh, well, you had to bring up politics. Oh, crap.
Yeah, sorry. But it's kind of there are some commonalities there, and I think one of them is I mentioned that debating tech. I mean, there's debating techniques that I see being used in these dialogues when they do happen, that are just very polarizing. First of all, you don't call anyone names, right? That's a bad thing. But the debate I mentioned earlier, where the guy said, I don't want to stand before God and call him a liar. Well, I mean, the conversation ends there, or poisoning the well. Well, you believe that, so do So do communists. So, you know, those sorts of debating techniques. I don't know. I feel like politically what's going on in America is there's a environment now where people who had to hide their hatred, they now have the opportunity to be as hateful as they want to be, as loud as they want to be. And that's a problem.
It's bad.
And I feel like it's the same way in Christianity. You have conservative churches and conservative people who they're just not. I mean, if I don't know, it people are leaving, but I don't see any real change happening from the top down or the bottom up. And to happen from the top down, people are going to have to change their entire theology and the things they wrote, the books they wrote. And I just don't see a whole lot of people doing that. And the people that do it, like Peter Enns, you know, he gets fired from his job at a conservative seminary, or other people who make those decisions, they're just out the door. Or, you know, Frank Schaefer, you know, he has nothing to do with LaBrie and all that kind of stuff that his parents started, or the religious right or any of that kind of stuff. So when there's these institutions in place, if anyone's trying to, you know, buck the system or challenge the institution, boy, they bunker down and fight the battle. Mm-hmm. And I think what's lost is I think it's 7 million people over the last 10 years or something have left the church. It's some enormous number like that. There's souls at stake.
Yeah, the fastest growing church there is.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And
you mentioned atheists, but I can tell you, I've run into a few atheists, but most of the people that I know that claim they're atheists, they're really not. They're just an atheist that doesn't believe in the God that they were taught. And I would say I am too. If I had to go back into my former church and they asked me if I was a Christian or an atheist, I would say, I know I'm an atheist because the God that you're teaching, I don't believe in. I don't want to have anything to do with. There's some heartbreaking things happening here.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think you just sort of bridged the gap with that last statement. I can't. When you talk to somebody across the table and they say, you know, I don't believe in God, and they give you the reasons, usually I'm on board with the reasons why they don't believe in God. I can't believe in a God like that either, you know. And I think that's really what's healing, is that, you know, you're able to, you know, listen to them. And if anything, it affirms, you know, like, we really have messed up in our theological pursuit of trying to hold on to people. And I do think that churches... Churches are institutions that can be insecure, and you know, trying to, you know, have people stay in order to justify their existence, you know, as opposed to, you know, if they weren't so insecure, they'd be able to say, okay, we're confident enough that if you leave, if our institution is with you at all, you'll come back. But a lot of churches just aren't there, you know. So, you know, if you leave, you know, you're likely to, you know, fall off the path, and you'll probably end up in hell. You know, so, you know, that's more than, you know, what I've heard, you know, people have experienced, you know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, let me ask you this: who have you been reading? I know you had the time in seminary, but maybe just books that have come out. What books have you read that really kind of shaped your position recently? Or, I mean, you could have read the books a long time ago, but your position that you have now, what are those foundational texts?
Wow. I had a professor who wrote a lot of books. Her name was Sally McVeigh, and she's been a theologian all her life. And we were fortunate to have imported her from the U.S. to Canada. And but she's written some great books. I've got one called The Models of God, Theology for an Ecological Nuclear Age, which is just fascinating reading. And, you know, she approaches everything, you know, from a place of intrigue in the metaphor behind the scriptures. And, you know, she's a pretty liberal thinker, but, you know, she explains things so simply. And I think that's what intrigues me about her writing, is it's written for the common person who doesn't want to have to look up, you know, 10 different words before they understand the sentence. But she's also somebody that will contribute to, I think there is a guy named Alistair McGrath who mm-hmm. did this handbook of theology. It's probably in a lot of different seminaries. And it's just basically a thick book on theology, like it's almost like an encyclopedia, a compilation of different concepts. And she, even though he's coming from a very much more conservative perspective, she was able to contribute to that because she saw in his writing, he just really wanted to communicate this stuff in the clearest way possible without getting too opinionated about stuff, you know. So that helps out, you know, when you have that kind of dialogue happening between people. Who else? Let's see. Dorothy Soleil. She wrote a book, The Silent Cry, Mysticism and Resistance. And so, you know, that's kind of, you know, taking two different camps, you know, the mystical and, you know, the justice camps and sort of having that conversation. I don't know. I can't really think of any other books.
Excellent. Well, I know now why your theology is off, brother. You're reading books by women.
There you go. Yeah.
I mean,
they'll mess you up all the time.
I should have asked you that question first.
Yeah.
Then we would.
No, I mean,
apostasy of the last
I mean,
days, brother.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there's we're kind of taught that, you know, we're not supposed to have women teaching over us, right? You know, we can't really learn anything from them. So, you know.
Go ahead.
Well, and also I think, you know, whenever you have somebody from a different culture talking about their approach, that's helpful too, you know. Because the Western mind, you know, we just clamp down certain ideas and ways of thinking. But, you know, somebody who's coming at it from, you know, say Nepal or someplace like that, you know, or, you know, a place of oppression like North Korea, you know, their theology is going to look a lot different than ours. And that's helpful too.
And one bad thing is we don't have enough of that. I mean, we had, you know, last century, I guess, the German theologians and we really mm-hmm. don't have a lot of theological writing on an academic level. Or at any level, coming out of that I've seen anyway, you know, we've just now have where women, you know, a Rachel Held Evans can publish a book or whatever. That's kind of a new thing. We don't have a lot of that I've seen theological writing coming from Africa or other countries. So we're only getting a biased perspective of you know, and I would say a privileged perspective too. You know, the German theologians. I mean, you mentioned. You know, somebody living in a place where there's a lot of persecution, they're going to come out with a whole different idea of things
right.
than a German guy who, you know, sitting in a castle writing a book in the 1800s is going to have. So it's going to be interesting to see when that stuff comes out.
Yeah, that's right. It's how you position yourself in the story. You know, you might see, you know, a lot of people will identify with, you know, maybe Jesus. Maybe somebody from you know, who's come from a place of, you know, oppression and hiddenness, they're going to be from the perspective of who the person is that Jesus healed, you know, or was reaching out to. So, you know, it's all about perspective. That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I really enjoyed Rachel Held Evans' books, Evolving in Monkey Town, and I forgot the name of the other one. Those are both really good because her journey was just like mine. And some of the comments she would get when she was questioning things were the same things I got. And she mentioned a couple times people would just kind of say in a snide way, praying for you. You know, I got that quite a bit as well. Like,
yeah.
Oh, it's such a loaded, loaded small little sentence there. Are you just, right. you're just thinking too much, brother. It's, you got to have faith. You got to just put your faith in God. You're trying to intellectualize things. It's like, no, I just have questions. You're saying this and it's inconsistent with, you know, whatever. So there was a lot right. of, yeah. a lot of that. I'm sure, you know, you've experienced it too. And a lot of the people out there have as well. But anyway, this was a great conversation. Yeah. And I know we had wanted to talk about a bunch of other stuff, so we'll definitely have this conversation again. It's always awkward the first time you talk to somebody. So now that we know where each other stands a little bit, I think we'll be able to have some good ones. But what is your favorite Christian album now, or your favorite band that has non-Christians in it? Is that a valid question?
Oh, okay.
Or favorite post-Christian band, if you want to call it that.
Yeah. I really like the Low Tom album that just came out.
Yes.
I mean, I think, yeah, and the thing is, like, you know, you got the guy from Starflare, Bazan from Bazan and Pedro, and then the T.W. Walsh, he's played in a number of different bands. And you had mentioned that T.W. Walsh worked with some of your stuff, some of your recordings.
Yeah, he mastered, did an album under the name Motonaut. It was me, and it was like a synth pop thing.
How was your experience?
It was great.
Yeah, how was your experience working with him?
Yeah, that was the first album I ever cool. got mastered, you know, so I emailed him some stuff, and then at one point, because I'm super obsessive, I like slightly remixed something, not that anyone else could hear the difference, and I said, hey man, I'm really sorry, and he just did it anyway, you know. He's a super nice guy. In fact, that's how I got in touch with Down the Line, because Steve heard that and did an interview with me there.
Oh, okay.
And I got roped in at that point.
Okay.
So, yeah,
yeah,
it was great to work with.
I thought that might have been your connection. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah.
That was some good times. I can't believe it's almost been 10 years ago that I did that album. But
wow. Yeah.
Time flies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the, you know, intriguing part of that band. Oh, and then Trey Manning from the Lore 100 and His Name Is Alive, I guess on drums.
Yes.
And it's like and they mentioned that there's a video of them on KXP.
Yes.
Playing their songs live in a studio.
Excellent.
And they talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, they all met through these, you know, either Christian festivals or shows they've done. And so they all have that sort of context, you know, of working in a sort of the Christian indie scene, if you want to call it that. But, you know, like, none of that seems to really be what cements it now for them. You know, it's, you know, and again, you don't know where everyone's at. You know, they're not really up front. They're not talking about, you know, like, I moved on from that, or, you know, you can sort of pick out pieces from different interviews of where, you know, they might land on some of those issues. But, you know, the fact is, it's great music. And it's kind of, lyrically, it's, you know, you can put your own meaning into it. Musically, it's all over the place. You know, there's some classic rock in it. There's definitely the, you know, the integration of great players playing together, you know, and doing some crazy stuff.
Yeah, that's a great record. And the video that you mentioned, just look Low Tom, two words, on YouTube, and the radio video will come up, and they do a great job live. Anyway, we're running out of time. What do you have coming up in the next print edition of Down the Line?
Well, let's see. I actually did an interview with Frank Schaefer, and that was kind of on your recommendation.
Yes, I'm glad you did. I've enjoyed his books as well.
Yeah. No, I find his stuff intriguing. And so he was, you know, kind enough to answer some of my questions and, you know, get that ball rolling. Wiley from 2 Minute Minor. He lives up in Chicago, and he's in a punk band there called 2 Minute Minor. And you know, so very, that was a fun thing to do. That's my contribution to the latest. How about yourself?
Yeah, I reviewed the Alarm show that they posted already.
Yeah.
I reviewed the U2 show, and I'm not sure what else I got cooking. There's always an iron in the fire somewhere. Matt's been doing most of the work, but we wanted to get this new podcast launched. And, you know, I'm still hosting the Basement Tapes podcast. So I'm hoping to get a few more of each out. Well, maybe not a few more, one or two of each out before the year ends. And that being said, so we have two podcasts now. The Basement Tapes is like for usually super indie music. So if anybody out there fits that genre, contact me. I'd love to have you on there. In this podcast, obviously, we're all over the place, but this is more coinciding with the new direction of the magazine, which is going to be a little more evolved, I guess, going into some different directions. And, you know, our audience, a good bit of them are post-evangelical or post-Christian. So the
heretics,
yeah, they are. They heretics. Are, yeah, they're all heretics.
Yeah.
So there's some interesting stuff out there, and I'll plug this podcast. So the second episode, I interviewed Brian Gadawa, who wrote some great books on some great fiction books. But what we talked about, if you haven't listened to it yet, is the end times, and he defends an Orthodox preterist position. Which I had mentioned the article Lecour that you mentioned before, how at least this article that's talking about the new naivete and post-critical thinking says that Jesus was wrong. C.S. Lewis actually said Jesus was wrong about the timing of his return. There's another way to look at that. That's another Orthodox position. I know this is a contentious issue, but when Jesus says stuff like this generation will not pass away, that was one of those early things for me that I was like, wait, what? That's, you know, that you're taking it way out of context to, you know, make it seem like he's talking about anything else but this generation. But anyway, that's a good one. So if that's something that's been troubling anyone's faith, go back and listen to the second episode with Brian Gadawa, because it'll maybe, hopefully, start you thinking about things in a new direction. But anyway, thanks, Doug, and we look forward to seeing what
you
got written down and having a good conversation with you again.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.